This is the Senate Committee on Government Operations and Elections, Friday, June 14, 1985, 9 a.m., Hearing Room C.
House Bill 2212 is a, been identified as an omnibus bill, and I'll go through it section by section. Section 1 is an amendment to the provision dealing with the purchase of voting equipment by the Secretary of State for use by counties. On page 1, it lines 14 and 15, we're asking a change in that so that counties can accelerate payment. The way the law is presently constructed is that they may the counties may not pay more than 20% plus 5% of that amount over a period of 4 or 5 years. Some counties want to pay quicker than that in order to save money. So what we've done is we've changed it to a minimum threshold of not less than 20%, and then they can pay any amount greater than that that they choose. Section 1A at page 2, starting on page 1 and continuing the first nine lines of page 2, is a situation where voter registration cards must be turned in not later than the fifth day after some person other than the original person who registered takes that card. And this is particularly a situation on special registration drives where people who have conducted special registration drives need to get those cards into the county clerk. Oftentimes these are held for a longer period of time than are truly necessary and causes a great deal of confusion among the voters and also creates a great deal of workload for the county clerk. Section 2, line 10, refers to section 6, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Section 4 is the provision dealing with the penalty for falsifying voter registration information. And that is information that is printed on the voter registration card and is also the penalty. Over in section 9 at page 3, lines 9. Secretary of State Roberts asked yesterday for an amendment to restore the fact that this is a five-year penalty, in other words, a Class C felony. So if the committee would, at line 17, page 2, remove the brackets and delete 1 year, and then in the place of $2,500, insert $100,000, that would make the amendment complete. The reason for that money amount is that that is the standard penalty amount for a Class C felony. Yes, at line 17, remove the brackets.
This is on page 2?
Yes, sir, the printed bill. House Bill 2212.
A engrossed?
Yes.
Okay.
Delete 1 year, insert 5.
Well, 5 is there already in the bracket. If you delete the bracket, you will have had...
There's two sets of brackets.
Yeah, both brackets.
You want them all out.
Yes.
Can I have a copy of A engrossed, House Bill 2212?
You have both, don't you?
I have one.
We take out in the penitentiary, we take out 5 years. We insert.
Thank you.
Well, no, you leave that in.
We're taking out the brackets.
What bill?
Now we're going to bracket 1 year.
Yes. And when we originally proposed this, what we were doing was we were trying to make consistent the dollar fine that is applicable in all cases of a Class C felony, which is $100,000. That was a change made last session by the Judiciary Committee. So if you were to remove the brackets, page 2, line 17, of the two bracketed statements, delete 1 year, and put $100,000 in lieu of the $2,500, you will have restored it to the status that the Secretary of State submitted it at the start of the session.
Chair?
Senator Riles.
Is this a conceptual change then?
No, ma'am.
Okay. You used to be able to get, this was only going to happen to you. You're going to get 1 year and $2,500. Now you're going to get 5 years and $100,000?
No, no. Let me start again.
That's a big change.
In 1975, when registration by mail was authorized in the state of Oregon, one of the key points of that authorization was a concern that people would frivolously register to vote. To discourage that, it was decided by the Assembly in 75 that it would be an onerous, they would set such an onerous level for the falsification of that information that that would in fact cause people not to frivolously or in some way provide false information on voter registration cards. And for the most part, it worked. And all we set out to do at the start of the session was really correct a glitch. And that was that the dollar amount is inconsistent with the uniform criminal laws with respect to the penalty for a Class C felony. And it got completely turned around by making it a misdemeanor, which is not something that we think should be done. So what we're saying is if we could go back to what we originally asked for, was to correct the dollar amount, leave everything else alone, that would correct the one mistake that should have been caught last session in judiciary and wasn't. That's what we set out to do. It got a long way from what we started with. So if we could simply then, the statement at line 17 be imprisonment in the penitentiary for more than 5 years or to a fine of not more than $100,000. That's the way the sentence would read, or that part of the sentence would read. Section 5. This is a... yes, sir.
Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4. Is there objection to that amendment?
No.
Okay, so moved.
Section 5. With respect to changes of a boundary, the county clerk is expected to alter the voter registration card in place in the file in the office. In counties such as the counties of Multnomah, Washington, Lane, Marion, and those larger counties that have computer capabilities, that isn't truly necessary. All of that information is maintained by computer. Voter registration cards are filed alphabetically, so there's no need to force that manual clerical effort any longer. So what we're saying is, but in some counties, small counties, the manual effort is still important. So what we're asking is at line 22, you make it permissive so that a county clerk may change the voter registration records when a precinct changes, but not require that they change it because it's no longer less necessary in the computerized counties. Section 6, no person shall, this is new, no person shall alter any information supplied on a registration card except an elections officer or a person who helps another person register to vote. We have no prohibition in Oregon law for people altering voter registration cards. We had experience last year where persons were doing special registration drives and then were changing the party designations on those registration cards. We investigated it, we determined in our minds who the person was, and then we said, where do we go from here? And there was no place to go. So we need to have the prohibition. This is prior to 1975, and that is really when a lot of things changed and we're catching up to it. We had deputy registrars, and the registrar was legally responsible for the accuracy and the integrity of the information on the card. With registration by mail, that's the registrar program obviously is no longer necessary. So in order to protect the system, we're going to maintain that a person cannot change that or they're subject to a Class C felony, which is also in Section 9, which I'll talk about in a minute. But so it's a crime if you go around changing person's registration cards. Section 7, here is a situation where we're trying to amend to accomplish a fairness among major party registrants and independent electors. As the situation is now, the law is clear that within 20 days of an election, you may not change your affiliation with a political party. But the law is silent with respect to a person changing their affiliation from an independent to a major party. What we want to do is create the balance here so that whether you're a major party person or whether you're an independent elector, within 20 days of an election day, none of you can change your designation of party choice, so that the independent person doesn't have an edge on a person who has earlier chosen to be a member of a major political party. Section 8, we are here dealing with a challenge process. Last year, I had a great deal of experience with our voter registration laws, and we found a whole lot of little things that would have been nicer if they'd been in the statutes and were not. At page 3, lines 3 through 7, what we're doing here is we're changing the process with respect to challenging in the poll book. Conceptually, the way you challenge in a poll book is you go into the clerk's office and you just merely write down in the remarks section that challenge information. And that's the end of it. Arguably and technically, if the elector comes into the polling place where the challenge has been entered in the poll book, there's still no challenge necessary, which seems a little bit ridiculous, but nevertheless it is, because all that was a challenge was the entry in the poll book. Secondly, if it's a frivolous challenge, that elector has a right of redress through a civil process if they choose to sue the person for frivolously challenging for the aggravation of doing it. In that case, then, we need a continuity, and there isn't any, because there has to be a sworn affidavit by the person challenging that you're not qualified to vote. That way, then, there's a possibility of redress myself to you as the challenger. What we've provided at lines 3 through 7 is the platform for both making the challenge appropriate through an affirmation by having you fill out the challenge form individually in each case that you choose to want to challenge a person's right to vote, and then that challenge form will be sent on to the polling place so that if you show up, you'll know who accused you, what the accusation was, and that person has so stated under oath, and then you can, of course, respond to that and vote or choose not to respond and not vote. But in any case, it would be a fair status. As it is now, a challenge in the poll book doesn't really have an application either in civil process or in the ability to stop somebody from voting at a polling place. Section 9 is the penalty provisions for the voter registration. And what we've done is we've added Section 6, which is that business about persons changing information on a registration card. And consistent with the change the committee adopted just a few minutes ago, we need to restore Class C felony at line 9, page 3, and remove a misdemeanor at line 10.
So move, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Roberts,
moves that change.
Yeah. Senator Roberts moves that change as outlined by Ray Phelps. Is there objection? Hearing none, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 10, page 3, lines 24 through 26. This will be in several other sections, and I'd spend a few minutes with it here. This is a statement that a person who signs, in this instance, it's a nominating petition, a minor political formation, minutes of an assembly, and so forth. In other words, the candidate petition process to the ballot. Once that elector has signed it and that petition has been turned in for signature verification, that elector may not remove their name from the petition. Now, administratively, we don't allow that because it's just not conceivable for us to go through and find that name. Nor, secondly, we don't want to have candidates disadvantaged by having turned in enough signatures and then have some people come in and remove names and therefore the petition becomes deficient. So we've never allowed it. We feel more comfortable having it in the law. Section 11, we're making a statement here in that for purposes of nominations of city-county candidates, recalling city-county officers, or forming a minor political party, the individual form that's being used to accomplish these things is that form that the Secretary of State adopts by rule. We are having some instances where nominating petitions in city offices particularly are deficient to the current status of the law with respect to verifying signatures, and also some recall petitions are deficient. And what we need to do is to make it perfectly clear to everyone that the state's form is the one that will accomplish the policy of election law. And so that's Section 11. Section 12, we are requesting here that the candidates for Metro be no longer required to file with the Secretary of State, but rather file in the county where they're running. In other words, in the county with the administrative office, which in effect is Multnomah County. There's no reason for those candidates to come down here and file as state candidates when all of their process is in the Tri-County area of Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington County. This policy was adopted in 77 and referred to the people for a vote in 78, but I think it was maybe a policy based more on let's get started and find out if we got everything in the right place. Well, not discussing Metro, but discussing the nomination and election of candidates, I think everything is in the right place. So I think it's well that we just move it where it belongs. Section 13, here we're changing some of the arithmetic, if you will, for doing a petition for nomination. In reading the statute, it is not clear that we're dealing with a petition process in the electoral district, and I'm at page 4, lines 19 through 24. What we've tried to do is clarify that you're going to get your signatures in a certain fixed number of precincts, and those precincts are the same. We've not changed that, but we're dealing with precincts of the electoral districts rather than precincts of the county. We have discovered, particularly in the large counties, that if we were to apply this standard, it wouldn't work, because with reapportionment and then the reduction of some of the precincts in certain electoral districts, you'd have to get signatures out of every precinct in the entire district in order to qualify to be 1/8 of the precincts of the county. And what we're dealing with here is just merely saying, all right, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it within your electoral district. I think this is a carryover from when we did not have single-member districts. This would be something that occurred prior to 1971 when Oregon adopted single-member districts. Prior to that time, candidates ran countywide. Section 14, here we're making clear that in addition that the policy presently in the law with respect to Metropolitan Service District candidates, which is at line 33, page 4, we're carrying it over and putting it into the election code so there's no inconsistency. The policy has been, since the inception of Metro, that executive officer and counselors would run at the primary, and if they achieved more than 50% of the vote, they would be considered elected and therefore not have to run at the general election or be on the ballot at the general election. That's in Chapter 268, which is the principal act of Metro. But it is not carried over in the election law, and it could create an argument, and we want to resolve it. It came up just briefly last year. We talked our way through it. This makes it clear, and that would resolve the problem so that in the election law, as well as in the principal act of Metro, the policies are consistent. Section 15, we have here asked for a process where the Secretary of State may, by rule, adopt a schedule for filling the vacancies of major party candidates. And this is going to be in a different context. This policy is going to be in other parts of this bill. What occurs in these instances is that, according to Oregon's Constitution, any vacancy more than 20 days before a general election must be filled by election. The problem is when that vacancy occurs as it grows near to the 20th day. And in order to try to have a uniform process and to try to treat everyone fairly, we need to have a nominating process. And so what we're trying to do here is to say we will, by rule, create an administrative rule for the purposes of everybody understands what the rules for the nomination is, or are, rather. That's not clear now, and I've tried several different ways to figure out how you can put it in statute, and the problem is when the vacancy occurs relative to the 20th day before the election. And then you have to abbreviate certain things as you get nearer to the 20th day. So we're asking for that authority by rule, and we will be having other parts along the way where this is the same. In Section 16, we're asking for a clarification, which has created a problem for us, and also, again, the information with respect to the rule for nominating process on a vacancy. I'm at page 5, lines 20 through 22. That would be the authority to create a rule to fill the vacancy if there is one after all processes for nomination are closed. But above that, we are clarifying a glitch which occurred in 1979. We're saying that here, a A major party may nominate a candidate to fill a vacancy in a partisan office in the following manner, and it provides what those are. And then at line 8, it says the procedure under sub 1 shall not apply. And what was intended is what's said here. The procedure doesn't apply when you're going to fill a vacancy in Congress pursuant to a special provision for a special election, or you're going to fill an office in state legislature through the appointment process during an interim, or you're not going, or you're going to fill a county office by the county commissioners. The way the original language was written, it was construed that there was no process for filling vacancies but by election. And that was really a tortured rationale, but nevertheless, that's where the Attorney General came from. So this clarifies the policy. It makes no new policy.
Ray?
Yes, sir.
We have other bills on the agenda this morning. We go into session at 11. I wonder if you might be able to speed it up just a little, please.
Okay, section... Let me do this. Section 17... again, we're asking for the process for a nominating schedule when a vacancy occurs for a person not scheduled to be on the ballot.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Monroe.
Ray, an incident occurred in Multnomah County in 1980 with respect to a candidate for the state senate attempting to void his nomination, and he found that it was illegal to void his nomination, to resign his nomination within, I think it's 60 days?
70.
Set within 70 days of the election.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that candidate then had to take some unusual circumstances of moving out of the district to try and get that nomination voided in order to meet the need. Mm-hmm. Have you dealt with that problem in this bill at all?
No, sir, I have not. In fact, the section we're on is the section in question.
Did you consider the possibility? It appears to me that that putting a candidate in a position where the candidate no longer wishes to be a candidate for a particular office, but is forced to take some kind of unusual action to sort of artificially make himself ineligible for office because he can't resign a nomination in the last 70 days is kind of a quirk in the law.
Well, you have to have some sort of a threshold, otherwise people will be coming and going. Now, you could argue that the 70th day is too long. Maybe you want to abbreviate the 70th day.
Seems to me that 30 days might be more appropriate. Okay.
At the 30th day, though, all the ballots have been printed, as well as the voters' pamphlets have been printed and are ready for distribution. And so there are a lot of, and then the person who would replace that nominee would have no access to any of that. You'd probably get your name on the ballot, but there's no way you could get the voters' pamphlet.
The person who replaced the nominee in the situation I was talking about did not get into the voters' pamphlet.
I know.
But won anyway.
I understand. It's a policy call on when you want to allow withdrawal and when you want to not allow withdrawal. And the law presently is 70 days.
Okay, but you haven't dealt with that in this bill.
No, sir, I have not. Section 18 is a minor change with respect to assembly of electors, in that we need the names and addresses of certain individuals participating in that process. Section 19 is again the process for filling a vacancy and nomination when it's too late to do it under ordinary circumstances, and the Secretary of State is asking for rulemaking authority to do that. Section 22 is a change to reflect the election last November where the recall provisions in Oregon's Constitution were changed, and we are at page 7, lines 2 and 3 and 4. We're just stating the language right out of the Constitution. Section 24, again, once an initiative referendum is submitted, no elector may remove their name. Section 25 is before circulating a petition, there has to be a prospective petition. And then also, we are asking that the signatures in the statement of sponsorship must be accomplished, accompanied by a certificate of the county clerk. We're required to turn in 25 names with a prospective petition. Persons don't always have those signatures verified, and that delays getting a ballot title. So we're simply going to have those persons get those signatures examined before they turn it in. Section 26, section 27, section 28 deal exactly, and 29 deal with the exact same policy, and that is in the case of counties, cities, and special service districts required to submit ballot titles for initiative petitions, that the person who is designated to write that title has 5 business days, not 5 calendar days. Section 30, we're asking for clear authorization. It's always been the practice and policy, but it came up last year, but we're asking for a clear authorization that justice of the peace not be included in the state's voters pamphlet. Section 30A is an amendment that a person using a picture in the voters pamphlet, that picture may be 2 years old instead of 1 year old. Section 30B is...
Let's stay with that. If I have a picture that I take before, I don't want to apply to me. I'm not up every 2 years, am I? It's not my problem.
It's mine. I don't want to do that whole thing. Why don't we make them 4 years old?
I couldn't touch it.
Your kids change too much in 4 years.
What?
Your kids change too much in 4 years.
Yeah.
Section 30B, if I may continue.
Look what a Senate session does to you.
This is a page 10, lines 5 through 8. We're indicating that the number of words as well as the amount of space. There's been a big hassle over how many words to get in that amount of space. And over time, we figured out that that's about what you can get. Section 31 adds 32. Section 32 deals with the challenge process for an absentee vote. We have an administrative procedure for that, but there's nothing in Oregon law as to how you challenge an absentee ballot. We think that's a good addition. And Section 33 is consistent with the change we talked about earlier on voter registration, and that is that no one may alter what is supplied by a person seeking an absentee ballot on that application other than somebody in their official capacity. And we provide that if you do alter that information, for example, changing a Democrat to Republican or something like that at the primary, that that's a Class C felony. Section 35, we're asking here to change the process for counties to make it consistent with cities, lines 30 through 33, page 10, so that if they lose a measure in March, they can immediately resubmit it in May. If they lose a measure in September, they can immediately resubmit it in November. With the 61 filing day, or 34-day filing day, they can't get there from there. And this gives them this extra process. 254, we're asking here for a change in to make uniform the process where you can summarize ballot measures on a uniform statement posted in a voting booth, just as you have in Multnomah County, and a person then would have merely the caption to have to look at on the ballot. If they wanted to read the full text of the ballot title, it would be there right for them to read. Section 37, we are creating a consistent buffer of 100 feet around the polling place for purposes of electioneering, exit polling, and all the other things that aggravate voters who try to go and vote on election day. Section 38, here we're dealing with...
Mr. Chair, I know we're in here, but I wanted to ask one quick question. I had a constituent ask me that there is a state law that requires a flag to be flown at every polling place?
No. There's authorization that a flag may be.
Oh, it's not a requirement. It's a maybe,
right.
Something within 100 feet. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Section, it used to be, and it's generally considered by most people that it is a law, but it isn't. Section 38, here we're talking about who may administer an oath at an election board when there is a challenge. The law was unclear as to whether or not it was exclusively the right or the authority of the chairperson only. Obviously, it should be the authority of any person on an election board. The next change is in the special district statutes. It's at page 12, lines 1 through 2. We're deleting the Secretary of State as the elections officer, so that the Secretary of State is not the elections officer for Metro. The county clerk then picks up that extra area of responsibility, and that's the change at lines 4 and 5. Section 40, here we're dealing with the special districts filing a ballot measure 40 days before an election, and that's a clarification of what is already stated in 1 and 2, but as it's stated in 1 and 2, it's not as clear as it's now stated. Section 41, here we're providing that in the case of a candidate election, when you have small districts and it's so expensive to give notice by newspaper, that the county clerk can, in lieu, or in addition to the newspaper, can also make a mailing to all the electors denouncing that the time for candidate filing is open. Section 42 is a provision that would require special districts to file measures 40 days before a primary, a general, and
right at the last 2 weeks before the, I'm not referring, by the way, to the governor.
No, I know the one you're referring. No,
there's another carpet salesman politician in our area.
Uh huh.
Yes, I know. He's run for several things.
Right. Is that in any violation?
I don't think so, Senator, because that's a normal course of business. Now we can argue about, sure, tell me about it, and why isn't he doing it today? But I think it would be very hard to demonstrate that wasn't his normal course of business. I think his intent is clear. I just don't think we could get at it. But I think in the case of his appreciation, I think that might be a little bit different standard. I think we could make the case.
Yeah.
What would be the case, Mr. Chair? In other words, that happens just before the election. Obviously, there's very little you can do about it before that Tuesday. But afterwards, you just file with the Secretary of State a complaint.
There's 2 years statute of limitation on that.
And the candidate probably, in some cases, had no control over it.
Yeah.
So who's the complaint against? The person that...
The person. Candidate's outside of it.
Yeah. And what would be their liability?
Well, it would be a criminal liability, and it would be a misdemeanor, and there could be penalties and fines as well. You get rather extensive.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, two comments. One is, I don't, in reference to Joe Smith that Senator Olson brought out, I don't know that Joe Smith is a particular dog lover. Maybe you don't know Joe Smith. And the other thing, I would certainly hope that there'd be no prohibition on having a smelk run before a primary election. Senator Simmons.
I wouldn't dream, Mr. Chair. I've always hoped that the Simmons Bed Company would have a tremendous big promotion the week before my election, but they never seem to cooperate.
And moving right along, right?
Or the Monroe shock absorbers.
Section 65, page 24, we're clarifying the statute at lines 23 and 24. No new policy. Line 27, that deletion is a deletion of a requirement that's 30 days after filing an initiative petition, and 260.118 is a requirement for identically the same thing, 15 days after the filing of an initiative petition. So it's not really a change in policy there either. With respect to the balance of the bill, Mr. Chairman, we're dealing here with questions about boundary changes and sequence of candidates' terms in office after formation elections. These are all clarifications, and there's no change in policy.
Okay. Any questions from members of the committee?
One last item, Mr. Chair, if I may. Section 82 is a repeal of that statute I was just talking about, 265-85. Okay. Section 83 is effective date of January 1, 1986, so we have time to implement many of these changes.
Okay. Any questions, Ray, by members of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I want to...
Senator Roberts.
For convenience, we took a kind of low priority bill, 2210. Mm-hmm. We took the content out of that. Mm-hmm. I wonder if we could just amend that into 2212. That was the one with reference to military,
right,
maintaining military registration. Remember that one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, I'd move that amendment.
Let's follow up here. Where is 2210 now?
It's in this committee.
Well, oh, in this,
we took 2210.
All right, I wasn't
got
there.
It in and
yeah.
Stuffed
it. 881 in it, Senate Bill 881, as I remember, in that,
right,
which is the contribution and expenditure reporting,
yeah,
bill that passed the Senate but did not pass, did not make it even to a hearing in the House, and so they removed the original content and replacing it here.
Okay. In other words, Senator Roberts moves that the content of House Bill 2210 be included in House Bill 2212.
Would you like to read the summary of that bill?
Yes, why don't you just give us a summary.
The summary of the original 2210 authorizes county clerk under certain circumstances to cancel registration of absent voter who is absent from place of residence and serving in armed forces or merchant marine or temporarily living outside United States. Requires county clerk to send written notice of inquiry to elector before cancellation and requires that elector have opportunity to respond. That's what the bill does.
Okay. Are there any objections to Senator Roberts' motion?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
why are we including that in this when that bill already passed?
That's the Senator Roberts. You want to respond?
Senator Yee, we took that bill, that title, and used it as a vehicle to send over to the Senate, to the House again, a measure which the Senate had already passed, but which the House committee never had a hearing on.
And they don't plan to have any hearing?
Well, they're all closed
down.
Well, they're shut.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. Was that Senator Hanvey's bill that you're talking about?
No.
Okay. I'm sorry.
This was a Secretary of State bill, which we substituted one Secretary of State bill for another, actually,
yeah,
when we inserted, when we used House Bill 2210 as the vehicle to get what was the bill?
It's Senate Bill 881.
To get 881 over to the Senate again, we took House Bill 2210 and put Senate Bill 881 in it to send over to the House again. That was all we did.
Secretary said
it was a very low priority and therefore it was a convenient vehicle. But Secretary of State would still like to incorporate that in to protect the registration of absentee military people.
Do we need her to come in to testify to that, or can Mr. Phelps?
No, the Secretary concurs with the request.
She said that, I think, in the hearing when we made the substitution. It's on the record. It isn't any personal information I have from it.
She also brought that up with me this morning to remind me that was something she wanted.
Okay.
Is there any objection to including or to Senator Roberts' motion to include House Bill 2210 into House Bill 2212? Seeing no objection, it's so moved. Senator Roberts now moves House Bill.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Pardon me, are there any questions, Ray?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate page 15, section 51A, which does allow for a repeal. But I don't know the cost that this is going to have on county clerks, but I do know the cumulative cost on county clerks and the effect that's having. So I would move that section 51 and 51A be deleted from the bill.
Senator Olson moves that section 50 and 51A?
51 and 51A.
Pardon me. Senator Olson moves.
I guess we'd take 50 out as well, don't we?
Yeah.
That's right.
50,
yeah.
51, and 51A.
50, 51, and 51A, page 15, lines 18 through 25.
Okay. Senator Olson moves that we delete section 50 51 and 51A from House Bill 2212.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roberts, then Senator Monroe.
I think that that the potential value of this to the public and to people who might have some questions may overweigh the very minimal cost. Notice you're only would only have a recount count of one contest in one precinct. That's pretty minimal. And how long would that take?
Less than an hour.
Less than an hour.
You're doing it after every other procedure that you're doing is completed.
Yeah.
Because it's 37 days.
Take probably less than an hour. That's pretty minimal to give some assurance that the machine indeed was working properly.
Any further discussion? Senator Monroe.
Yes. I'm going to oppose the motion primarily because of the sunset date that's in this part that limits it to one election cycle, the 1986 election cycle. It's an experiment. I think it's a reasonable experiment. See whether it works and helps us gain more faith with the voters. It's really crucial that the voters have faith in the integrity of the electoral system. And this is designed to do that. We hope that it will help. If it doesn't, it sunsets after one election cycle. I think it's reasonable to have it in here.
Okay, further discussion?
Mr. Chair, what is a vote tally?
That's the computer.
The vote tally system.
That's the computer.
That is a computer.
Yes.
Why didn't you say computer?
Well, there are different kinds of computers. Vote tally is a generic term. They'll pick them all up regardless of what you're using.
Well, my county clerk objected to it, too, but I'm not sure that it's...
I wonder if there was some misunderstanding about what it was.
Well, I think part of the objection was the way it was originally proposed. It's been knocked down from what it was originally proposed, and the sunset provision was not there when it was originally proposed also. So this is a compromised position with, my understanding, Mr. Stearns talked to Representative Bunn, and that kind of worked out some of the problems that some of the clerks had with it. Now, I cannot represent to you that took care of the Jackson County clerk or it took care of the Washington County clerk, but I think it's an experiment worth trying.
Further discussion on Senator Olson's motion? Lannis, would you call the roll, please?
Monroe?
No.
Olson?
Aye.
Roberts?
No.
Ryle?
No.
Simmons?
No.
Yee?
No.
Mr. Chair?
No. Motion failed. Senator Roberts?
Yes.
Senator Roberts moves A. Engrossed House Bill 2212 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Yee.
I've heard rumor that the open primary question is in this bill. Is it in here?
No.
No.
Because I missed part of the discussion.
It was, he said.
It was in this bill. A whole lot of things used to be in this bill.
But open primary is not.
Any further discussion? Glennis, can you call the roll, please?
Monroe?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Roberts?
Aye.
Mr. Ryle?
Aye.
Simmons?
Aye.
Yee?
Aye.
Mr. Chair?
Aye. Motion carried. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2092. Who would like to carry 2212? Senator
Olson.
Okay, we've opened the work session on House Bill 2092.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Simmons.
I, as you are aware, I think was in two committees yesterday trying to make up a quorum of one or the other. And when I came in, there was a motion to amend on the floor in front of the committee, and I wasn't aware of the import of it, and I had in mind another amending motion, and so I voted for it in error. And I would like to move that the amendment that was passed yesterday be deleted from the bill.
Senator Simmons moves that the amendments that were adopted yesterday to House Bill 2092 be deleted from the bill. It's a discussion.
Mr. Chair.
And Senator Olson.
I think it's clear what we were doing yesterday. It would be nice if people sat closer up here that are in the room, because I've talked to each of them openly about what we're trying to do here. I think that, and Senator Riles and I just openly talked about it. The question is whether or not the word incumbent is really a slogan, really, because it does have a positive impact on whatever name that antecedes. And I think that the position that we're talking about in particular, but any elected position, the wrong place to try to redress problems with the political process and the campaign process that gets that name on the ballot to the day of election is on the ballot itself. That's the wrong place to try to shade differences in what's available as far as fairness goes in the political process of campaigning. And using the ballot to make up for that difference and the word incumbent behind a name on that ballot to me seems grossly unfair and inappropriate, especially in the position of a judicial race. So again, I'll oppose the motion and on the floor if necessary. I think that there are serious questions that have been raised in this issue about the fairness of what judges can and can't do in running for office, and there are probably better ways to take care of that than on the ballot itself.
Okay, further comments on Senator Simmons' motion? Lennis, would you call the roll, please?
Monroe?
No.
Olson?
No.
Roberts?
No.
Rao?
Aye.
Simmons?
Aye.
Yee?
Aye.
Mr. Chair?
Aye.
It's an even split.
It's 4-3.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
Well then, Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2092 to the floor to pass.
Senator Simmons moves House Bill 2092 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Yee.
I may support the bill so that it can go to the floor for deliberation, but I may not support it on the floor.
Okay.
Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Ditto.
Any other disclaimers? Okay, Glennis.
Monroe.
Aye.
Olson.
No.
Roberts.
No.
Riles.
Aye.
Simmons.
Aye.
Yee.
Aye.
Mr. Chair?
Aye. Motion carried.
Mr. Chair, by not necessarily a vote explanation, but a word of appreciation to the committee for accepting my contriteness for my error yesterday, and I guess it's symbolic of the situation that we're in at the close of this legislative session. We're trying to do too many things at once, and my own opinion is it would be far better to take an extra week and do things, shut the process off, but then clean it up in an orderly fashion instead of getting us involved in things that we are now. And again, I'm needed for a quorum next door, so I would like to be excused for that.
Okay.
Caucus and
okay. The next bill on our agenda is Senate Bill 791. Let me give you a little history behind that. I was approached by Mr. Galay, Mr. Van Brocklin of the City of Portland, and others, Burke Raymond of Multnomah County, and others about an amendment that was needed to a piece of legislation we passed in 1983, known as the seepage fee bill, and related to system development charges. We had a bill in conference which would have been the perfect vehicle, and we had our conference committee report at 11 o'clock, and at 1 o'clock I heard from Mr. Burke Raymond about the problems that we had with the seepage fee bill that we passed in 83, so I told him it was too late for that bill. So they went ahead and they found another vehicle. to use. And they used, I had amendments crafted for this other vehicle, for this bill that was in IGA. And it was the seepage fee bill that we passed this year. Well, they appeared before the IGA committee, and they were right up to be next on the agenda. The House went into session. The committee adjourned permanently for this session of the legislature. So that left these amendments unadopted, and they were quite concerned about it. They came to me and asked if they could use this other vehicle, Senate Bill 791. And I says, it's not up to me. You go ahead and you ask the President of the Senate, which they did. And the Senate President did give his approval for that. So that's why we have Senate Bill 791 before us today. Now, our first action would be to remove Senate Bill 791 from the table.
I so move.
Senator Roberts moves Senate Bill 791 from the table. Glennis, please.
Monroe?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Roberts?
Aye.
Ryle?
Aye.
Yee?
Aye.
Mr. Chair?
Aye. Motion carried. Now, is there anyone here from the City of Portland or from Multnomah County that want to give a brief testimony on the need for the bill? Come forward, please, Mr. Galay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Gooley. I'm with the City of Portland. I'm representing the East County Sanitary Sewer Consortium, which consists of Portland and Gresham, Multnomah County, and the Central County Service District. The amendment that we are proposing clarifies a law that was passed in 1983 that, as the law currently reads, Multnomah County would be prohibited from imposing any systems development charges within an area where a seepage fee were being imposed. And the purpose of that law, as it was originally written, or the intent anyway, was to ensure that a particular systems development charge that Multnomah County now charges, which is a $500 fee for installation of a cesspool, would no longer be collected if a seepage fee were charged, because both of them had the same purpose, and there was no need to do one if the other. Unfortunately, when the language was drafted, rather than targeting that one specific systems development charge, which is the $500 fee for a cesspool or a septic tank, the language was basically generic and applied to all systems development charges would be prohibited if a seepage fee were charged. And therefore, it would prohibit collecting any kind of sewer connection fees and conceivably parks, systems development charges, systems development charges for streets or any other service. So we wanted to clarify the language that in the amendment that the systems development charges for the installation or replacement of cesspools or septic tanks would not be imposed if a seepage fee were imposed.
Okay. Senator Roberts moves the amendments to Senate Bill 791. Is there discussion on Senator Roberts' motion? Is there objection to Senator Roberts' motion? None so approved. Senator Roberts now moves Senate Bill 791 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Glennis?
Monroe?
Aye.
Olson?
Aye.
Roberts?
Aye.
Ryle?
Aye.
Yee?
Aye.
Mr. Chair?
Aye. Motion carried. I'll do it. Okay, the next bill on our agenda for a hearing is House Bill 2318 relating to creation of the Public Utility Commission of Oregon.
Mr. Chair?
send her out?
The Republicans have a caucus at 10:30.
Hmm. Okay. Well, we could have a hearing on the Public Utility Commission bill.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we still have four, right?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
No, there's four without. We don't need them.
No. Go ahead.
Go ahead and leave.
We don't need you.
We got some other bills we could take while they're gone.
Well, we even have a quorum. If we like the bill, we could pass it out.
Yes.
Yeah,
sure.
Now.
Well, Mr. Chair, just no minority reports on these bills.
Okay, we'll open up the public hearing on House Bill
2318.
Senator Olson.
Just for the record, I appreciate our administrator's objectivity, and on 2092, I'd appreciate her noting in the staff analysis the opposition that we had to the bill, too.
Oh, certainly.
Okay, great.
Okay. Who would like to testify on House Bill 2318? Sign-up sheet. Representative Matigue.
Yeah, maybe you need to send for him. He was in here quite a while. But, yeah.
Can we just recess for about 2 or 3 minutes while we round up a couple of people?
Yeah, okay.
What about the other bill?
Oh, you haven't got the other bill.
The other bill is being voted on by the House today, and we've been assured by the Senate President we'll have it as soon as they pass it.
Okay.
So we're going to have a meeting this afternoon?
3 o'clock.
Okay, yeah.
Our first witness is Representative Rick Bauman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the Strange Bedfellows Bill of 1985. I introduce them. This is to form a three-member appointed Public Utility Commission, referred to the voters in November of 1986, effective date April 1, 1987. The bill was introduced early in the session and reflects my commitment to, one, a multi-person commission, and second, an appointed commission. The responsibilities of the PUC has grown dramatically over recent years. It has responsibility for rail carriers, motor carriers, regulatory rate setting on regulated utilities, and the real areas of growth within those areas has been, one, hazardous waste shipments, and secondly, the breakup of the phone company and the effect that has had on their jurisdictions and their deliberations. We're the last state in the nation that has a single-member appointed Public Utility Commissioner. Those others that have, most of those others that still have single members with elected commissioners, have a much narrower Public Utility Commission. They don't reach into the rails and the transportation issues as much. I think it's time that we do two things by increasing the size of the commission. We allow for commissioners who will be allowed, hopefully, to specialize in areas and really get an in-depth knowledge of what's going on. And secondly, we bring their deliberations to in the open. When you have a single-member commission, what you have are deputy commissioners doing the hearings, recommending to the commissioner, and the decisions are made essentially in the privacy of the commissioner's office in closed setting. When you have a three-member commission, subject to the open meetings rules, the deliberations, the decisions have to be in public. I think the change is long overdue. I'm strongly supporting the fact that this needs to be referred, but that's part of the political compromise I think that's needed to get the bill through. And I think the changes are going to, in the long run, strengthen both public confidence and public acceptability of the difficult decisions that that office has to make.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask
Senator Roberts?
The comment you made, which is referring to the fact that these decisions would have to be made in public, I think emphasizes for me one of the really important aspects of this bill. What problem is there with reference to the majority of the commission conferring in private and only talking in public about what they've decided? Is there any way of dealing with that?
Open meetings.
That sounds to me like a real ticklish problem in this.
to make it possible for the commissioners to function at the same time to try to increase the probability that there would be a fair discussion of the decisions in public.
It's a difficult issue in terms of the open meetings law with any three-member commission, whether it's a county commission or any board of this nature, where when you have two members together, you have a quorum. And it's one that commissions have learned to handle, I think, by assuring that if they have to have those discussions, the content of those are later put on the record and that the full range of deliberations are made in public.
You think that's fairly well covered by the open meetings law?
Yes.
So it would deal with this situation?
What I would expect, hopefully, to happen, that you'd end up probably with one commissioner focusing on utility rates, one on telecommunications, one on transportation. That person would run the hearings in terms of whatever the decisions are before the commission, and in the end, that presenting effectively that recommendation to the full commission, where it'd be much more of a legislative hearing type procedure at that point.
Thank you.
Representative Bauman, did I understand you to say that this would be referred to the people?
Yes.
Yes, November 86.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Yee.
Representative Bauman, is there a designation about the representation on the commission, such as one from the industry, one from utility, one public member?
No, the commission would be appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, and serve at the pleasure of the governor. I think you're on the edge of the question of whether this commission should be elected or appointed. For plenty of arguments both ways, I fall on that those are very technical decisions, and you need to get the technical expertise in there, and you need the ultimate responsibility to be able to point a threat of responsibility, and that rests ultimately with the governor, as these are being his appointees. I don't think it's wise to designate these spots in terms of trying to get certain special interest groups represented. I think you need just real technical quality people, regardless of their expertise, regardless of their denomination.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, usually with commissions and boards, there are designations of one representative from industry, mm-hmm. one from public member, and one from...
This would be a little bit different. It wouldn't be, for example, like the Board of Forestry or the Environmental Quality Commission or something like that, where it's a part-time commission that is recommending actions to a